A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
I think our brain loves that feeling when we discover something new for ourselves and it has some use. Now, nature is not all about human beings using it, but our brain has evolved to love and find delight in things that help us.
Welcome to the Adventure Podcast and this episode with Tristan Gooley. Tristan is a natural navigator. He's written numerous books about the subject, and it was my love of these books that led me to get in touch with him and see if he fancied a chat. Tristan has spent decades hunting for clues and signs in nature across the globe, and has been nicknamed the Sherlock Holmes of nature by the BBC. This conversation went a little deeper and got a lot heavier than I think either of us would have thought, but it's a really honest, humbling insight into the life of a man who has found his place outdoors and the path that led him there. Before we begin, I'd like to mention that we're on Patreon. So if you're a regular listener to the podcast and would like to access extra content, including InVision interviews and monthly sit-downs with me and a guest, then you can find us on Patreon at The Adventure Podcast. I'd also like to talk to you about Sidetracked magazine, our sister publication. Sidetracked is an incredible quarterly journal that celebrates authentic stories of adventure and exploration. The same as us, they're big believers in story over hype, and their written words and incredible images have been a huge inspiration for me over the years. You can find out more at sidetracked.com. I'd also like to take a quick moment to push you in the direction of our charitable partner, the Martin Moran Foundation. They're a wonderful organisation working to get young people from disadvantaged backgrounds into the outdoors. There's a good chance that if you're listening to this, that you have an appreciation for the natural world already, but we're the lucky ones. You can find information about how you can support them on our Instagram bio at The Adventure Podcast. Finally, if you're enjoying the podcast, then please do subscribe on iTunes and leave us an honest review. They're a big help, and it really does help us bring the podcast to a wider audience. Okay, over to Tristan Gooley.
Thanks very much for doing this. I think it would be an obvious, logical place to start to just introduce yourself, tell me who you are and what you do, whatever that means to you.
Hi, Matt. I'm Tristan Gooley, also known as the Natural Navigator. I work full-time finding my way using nature, researching ancient and more recent techniques for how we can shape journeys using nature's signs.
Amazing. And I'm really interested in how one gets to that stage. You know, what are the early inspirations, or was it your childhood or a trip that led you to kind of embark on that path?
There were probably two important turning points. And the first was an understanding that I really enjoyed going on journeys, which sounds quite vague. So I'll be a bit more specific about that. I didn't know it in the early stages, but what I was loving was the shaping of a journey. So I didn't actually get very excited about the destination that often. I did sometimes, but the thing that really got me excited was that thing that all outdoors people can relate to, the spreading of the map on the table, the I am here, you know, what route am I going to take? And that led through a not straight line process to me understanding that I love navigation. I just love this wonderful art and science of how we find our way. And that combined with an equally strong realization that I wasn't I wasn't cut out to do everything in life. We all meet that moment where you wake up one day and you go, okay, I've had enough time on planet Earth now to realize there are one or two things I can do okay, and there are quite a few things I'm really not very good at. And I found something that I love and I seem to be okay at or quite good at. So all of that together led to a passionate drive to not master. There isn't the right sort of verb for this, but I had a kind of zeal to take on the art of navigation as far as I could. And then the next sort of turning point was an appreciation. And we're covering literally decades here, and we can drill in if you want to. But the next turning point was an appreciation that as my journeys were getting bigger and bolder and things like that, the testosterone sort of levels were you know as high as they needed to be. They weren't getting any more interesting, and I'd come back from an expedition with this strange. It was almost a sadness that some of the experiences I'd had as a very young person, perhaps a 10-year-old, were more interesting and more rewarding philosophically than covering 1,000 miles over several weeks. And that led to a fundamental shift. It coincided with an appreciation that I was spending too much time looking at kit. I was staring at screens and dials. And to be a competent navigator in the modern world, you need to know how to use this kit, of course. But I as a 10-year-old could walk up a hill and get huge satisfaction from thinking, do I take the left fork in the path or the right fork? And yet, ironically, in my 20s, I was, you know, staring at all sorts of bits of amazing kit. And so I started turning things on their head, and I started doing very short journeys, sometimes, you know, only a mile, just crossing perhaps the English countryside using nature signs, trees, flowers, stars. And it completely blew my mind and changed my life. And that's why we're chatting now.
That's amazing. And I think, you know, there's so much to go into there. But before we do, I think it would be good to understand a bit about almost like childhood and early years and how it was you got involved in the world of expeditions and travel.
Yeah, I was really restless from a young age. But it, like a lot of restless people, it didn't have much form. I know people who woke up at an early age and said, all I want to do is climb a mountain. It wasn't like that for me. It was more, being really honest, there was a bit of, you know, there's a bit of running away. It's not always, I don't think when we have a restless feeling, it's always an entirely positive thing. I don't think it's everything in life's absolutely fantastic, so I'm going to do something else that's equally fantastic. I wouldn't have been able to talk like this 20 years ago, but looking back on it, I think that's part of the restlessness is you're going, I don't feel terribly comfortable in you know, 19 out of 20 of the situations I find myself in. So I'm going to find that 20th thing. And for me, that was typically being on my own or in quite small groups. Nearly all of the expeditions I've done are small numbers. And I quite like that intimate relationship with finding my way and forging that relationship with the decisions in the journey.
That resonates with me so much when you say the 19 out of 20 situations. But I mean, I don't want to push and you don't have to, but what was it specifically that you think wasn't working for you as a child that led you to want to travel or well, run away, as you put it?
I'm not going to air tons of laundry here because I don't think that's what any of us particularly want, including me, but I could easily get out a sheet of paper and, you know, cover both sides of it very quickly with things that happened in the first 15 years of my life that I wouldn't want to go through again. This isn't a point scoring thing. And I think everybody could probably do that without, you know, and I congratulate people if they couldn't, but youth is tough. And if it's not, then, as a bit of a tangent here, something I've noticed is that now I'm firmly middle-aged, I've noticed that people who had a very easy childhood get very fidgety in middle age. And I think what happens is if you're lucky enough to be incredibly comfortable in the first 20 years of your life, you can be too comfortable in the following 20 years. And then you wake up one day and go, maybe there's a bit more than the repetitive situation I found myself in. And it may be that life's sort of kind in the sense that there's a balancing there, that we, you know, over, let's say, the first 40 years of our life, we all end up at the same place in terms of, you know, the swings and roundabouts, the pros and cons, that if you have a tough childhood, and I don't want to say tough, I mean, in some ways, I had an incredible childhood. I was privileged in many, many ways. But I was exchanging WhatsApp messages with a friend two nights ago, coincidentally, about, you know, some truly awful things that went on had made the press because other people had been brave enough to stand up and all that sort of thing. But that wasn't, I don't think, a big part of who I am or the choices I made. It's just one of those things that, if you're really, really, you know, hugely comfortable and happy in a sort of mainstream routine, why on earth would you go and do some stuff which might not go smoothly?
Yeah. Well, thanks for being honest and humoring me. And then, so what was it that you first did as part of your, you know, almost that chrysalis where you reinvented yourself or moved away and moved on?
Well, there was I'm lucky enough to be invited to speak to schools occasionally. And this is something I'm trying to share with them, is this idea that we're quite often discovering what our thing, in inverted commas, is, even before we're conscious that we're doing it. And by that, I mean those feelings of discomfort or occasional sort of joy is part of the process of working out what your thing is. And in that sense, being uncomfortable at times is a positive thing, because it's part of that process. And so what I was finding is that there would be moments, I mean, there's one particularly shaping episode where we were on a summer holiday, and my sister, my mother and I on the Isle of Wight, and she'd booked me onto a 5-day dinghy sailing course. And this really was getting quite close to how uncomfortable I could get, because I was going to be thrown in with a group of people I'd never met before to do a structured activity and something I'd, you know, never done before. And for lots of people, that's, oh yeah, lovely, lovely summer holiday. What more could you ask for? But for me, it led to massive rows with my mum. And I was 10 and she was wise enough to know that I would enjoy it. She just had to effectively trick me onto it. So she said, do the first day. If you still hate it, that's the deal. It's all off. And I, you know, wasn't at all convinced, but I thought, okay, that's a deal. I did the first day and it was life-changing. And what happened was this, the instructor came up to my sailing partner and me and asked on the fifth and final day, once we'd done the formal part of the course, where would you like to go today? And it wasn't like there were fireworks and classical music, but there was a definite realization and an excitement that I'd been given the skills to choose where I went. And the word navigation wouldn't have resonated with me at all. I would have struggled to define it probably as a 10-year-old. But there was some appreciation that I'd been given skills that, instead of waking up every morning effectively being told, this is the situation you're about to be put in, understanding that with these skills, you get to choose routes A, B, or C. And that was very appealing.
Was that for you just the literal sense of, I have navigation skills now? Or was there some metaphorical kind of learning in there about control of your own life or your own destiny, for want of a better word?
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. And I think it would be neat and tempting for me to sort of repackage it, but it's certainly not what it felt like. If somebody'd, and this is what I mean about us discovering our thing without always necessarily realizing it, and it's a process that goes on throughout life for all of us forever, certainly continues for me, is that the, you know, to put it in a bit of a Zen way, the universe is giving us messages all the time. And if somebody'd come up to me aged 20 and said, you know, why are you on planet Earth? What is the purpose of you? I would have found it an extremely uncomfortable question. I would have struggled to answer it. But I would have spent 10 years actually building up navigation skills. I just hadn't seen it. I mean, by that point, I'd led sometimes willing, sometimes reluctant mates all over the Lake District, all over the Brecon Beacons, all over, you know, bumpy parts of Britain. But I hadn't actually put the dot, you know, joined the dots to realize that I was discovering what my, you know, what my calling, if I can put it that way, was. So the you know, the 20s are a fascinating period for everybody. I've never met anyone who's had a dull 20s, I don't think, because it's freedom in its most brilliant and terrifying sense. We have suddenly, you know, economic demands that are a bit sort of scary, but then suddenly huge decisions. And I think that combined with a bit of finding out what our thing is can be the lighting of the fuse. And it isn't for everybody. And we all know those people who have that slightly distant, sad look in their eyes. But I'm a great believer that this process is ongoing, and it can start for somebody. Well, the fuse part can start in your 70s. But the discovery, yeah, it's going on, but we sometimes have to do a bit of rummaging around to spot it.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, you alluded to it before, but it was, you know, it wasn't the natural navigation perhaps that came first, or at least it wasn't the only thing. How did you get into the world of expeditions, and what did you get up to?
It was a learning process. So I enjoyed the restless tearing around over mountains and climbing into sailing dinghies as a teenager. But it was only in my early 20s that I thought, I'm going to see how far I can take this. And that led to initially, you know, a formal education. So, for example, the Royal Yachting Association has a very nice series of stepping stones: competent crew, day skipper, coastal skipper, yacht master, ocean yacht master. And so I think this is, again, when I talk to schools, if I talk to anybody, this is, you know, this is what I sometimes talk about, is you've got to find your thing, but then you've got to take some steps on your own, and then you've got to learn the game. And I think we all equally have got that experience when you try and pretend you know the game and you don't, and things start to unravel. So it was really, really a lovely time, because I thought, I know I want to be a navigator. I was honest enough with myself to say, you know, I'm going to get myself and possibly other people into real trouble if I keep making the journeys bigger without learning some formal skills. So I went through the formal process whilst working full time, mainly in the travel industry. So I'd take sort of 2 weeks off and you know, get another badge, as it were. And then the expeditions were building alongside that. And each expedition was about trying to take myself to another level of competence towards expertise. So, you know, a fairly classic example is, I forget exactly what age I was, somewhere in my 20s, I think. And I called up a friend and said, why don't we try and get from the south of England to the highest point in North Africa and back without buying a ticket? And this was a navigation training exercise for me as well as a holiday. And we sailed from Southampton to Jersey and the Channel Islands. We jumped into a light aircraft, flew down the west coast of France and Spain, landed at Tangier, went up in a 4x4 where the road stopped, put on the packs up to the summit of Mount Toubkal, and then back via a different route. I think the whole thing took only about 10 days from memory. And it just pushed me, bearing in mind the mate I did it with, he had a lot of land sort of focus skills, but he'd never skipped a boat or piloted an aircraft before. So it was, you know, large parts of the navigation onus were on me. And that was the aim. I got back and I was totally exhausted, totally elated, and felt that I'd nudged myself up a level in lots of areas.
And I assume on journeys like that, you're using, you know, the obvious modern GPSs and everything like that. And if so, when did you start to phase that stuff out, and why? What was the motivation?
Yes. I mean, in terms of aviation, and to a slightly lesser degree on the nautical side, you have to use kit you have by law. There's a very, very weird demonstration of this. So there's no law stating you have to have radar on a small boat, but if you have radar, you have to, by law, use it. So, and in aviation, you're breaking the law if you don't use all sorts of amazing bits of kit, most of which have three-letter acronyms. But that was round about the turning point. I'd certainly started taking on smaller journeys using natural navigation by then, but I'd committed myself as part of my sort of solo apprenticeship, is the only way I can put it, to attempt to fly solo and sail single-handedly across the Atlantic. And from the moment I made the decision to do that, to having completed it on the 1st of January 2008, I think it was a 7-year process, working full-time, saving, training, building skills. And by this point, you're building skills that are not easily accessible. And as a demonstration of that, I approached, it was either 7 or 8 professional pilots, who some of them were ferry pilots, the pilots who take small aircraft from parts of the world where they are to where they need to be, generally by high risk routes. And of those 7 or 8 that I approached, 3 were dead by the time I took off, having died in light aircraft crashes. But as all adventurous people will know, you have this amazing filter. You know, when I look back on that, I go, whoa, there were some red flags there. You know, when the people you're going to for advice are, you know, dropping around you, you're probably taking on a journey that you know, is not easy to get insured for. So I'd committed personally to doing that. On a personal level, there were some massive changes between the start and the end of that arc. I'd got married and become a parent twice over, which all parents will be familiar, completely changes the brain circuitry, and does not make things like this easier at all. And you know, I know you're a father, so you've probably encountered those sensations. But within that 7 years, I'd slightly fallen out of love with the philosophical cul-de-sac of doing a big journey for the sake of a big journey. And I'd fallen completely in love with the idea that we can read extraordinary things from the land or the landscapes we move through once we start using natural navigation. So the irony was, as I was doing the last couple of years of preparation and then the Atlantics, it felt like a happy chore. I'd emotionally and philosophically, I'd moved on quite a long time before, in a sense, but I did feel that it was something that I'd regret not completing. I'd invested so much time, money, effort. The way I sometimes put it, and again, expedition people like yourself will be familiar with this, is I had checklists of checklists. I had Excel spreadsheets spreading out into other lists. And my wife and I sometimes laugh because we'll go on a weekend away and she'll say something not quite as bad as "have you remembered your toothbrush?" But there'll be something starting with "have you remembered?" And I do remember that for the solo transatlantic sail, I had to remember over 1,000 individual items or to-dos prior to slipping out. And I got them all. So we have a good old laugh about that, because we then turn up on our weekend away and, of course, I've forgotten 3/4 of the things I meant to have remembered. But yeah, you're a dad. You know what I mean, how your perspective changes, I'm sure.
Yeah, radically. I mean, radically shifts, but that's a whole different conversation for another day. I think I'm going through a transition that you might have experienced, or it sounds like you have experienced, but we'll save my online therapy for another conversation. How did you feel when you touched down and it was done?
Genuinely happy to be alive, because expedition people will understand this sort of feeling. There's a positive feeling about physical safety. There's an excitement about doing something, you know, very mundane. There've been several times in my life where, you know, I've sort of thought just having a restaurant meal or something would be nice. But it was also an odd feeling, in the sense that it's the obsession, or the what sometimes feels like a best friend, sometimes feels like an enemy. Is effectively, you know, left the room with a wave, and that's it. So there's a slight hollow feeling as well, I suppose. But most of this sort of stuff, I think, the big stuff for all of us, and it's not just expeditions, it's anything, only really makes sense with a bit of distance. Because again, you know, once you, in the case of stepping off the boat, I hadn't slept for more than 1 hour, and typically not for more than half an hour at a stretch for 26 days. So I was not in great shape. But there's a funny story about that, which is the story to Mount Toubkal and back. I told my then girlfriend, now wife, that I was going to play golf, which was an open joke between us because I don't play golf, because I didn't want long conversations about how daft the whole thing was. And when I got back from North Africa, this sort of dates it a little bit, actually. I think, yeah, my first son had been born a few months before, and she handed him to me. And I was like, I didn't say it, but I was kind of like thinking, you know, a very self-indulgent, naive, early way of viewing parenthood. I was kind of like slightly expecting a, you know, darling, would you like a cold drink? You must be very tired. And it's like, there's your son. I'm going out the door. It's like, ah, okay. The penny's dropping here. So I psyched myself up, and this is weird but true. I psyched myself up at the end of the Atlantic, because it was obviously a conversation we'd had many, many times. And I'd actually said to her, look, because you know I'm quite wrapped up in this, I don't expect you ever, even if you really, really don't want me to do it, to say to me, I don't want you to do this. So I said, I'm happy to try and, you know, read the runes. If it's going to make you unhappy, you can say something weird. You can say something like, you know, are you not worried you're going to hit an iceberg? You know, my wife knows enough to know that that wasn't ever going to happen, but it could have been. It sounds really odd, but I needed her to have a way of communicating to me, you know, this show needs to stop, and it needs to be your decision. It, you know, it's not going to work in our dynamics if you kind of, you know, think for a few years that I'm the one who stopped it. But as part of that whole process, when I stepped off the boat, I was totally psyched up for 3 days nonstop childcare, and looking forward to it. And once I was in that rhythm of sleeplessness, you know, early childcare, as you'll be well aware, can be quite tiring, but it's not, you know, it fits quite neatly into solo sailing. So I stepped off the boat. We didn't discuss, you know, anything. You know, Sophie was able to go out, have a few drinks, have a laugh. And I think it was after about 36 hours, she went, all right, time served. You go and get some sleep.
I know that so well, that what you said about the naivety of, I had it. I mean, I won't do the full story, but just came home from a long trip expecting the kind of the red carpet and the confetti and the glass of champagne. And instead I was just handed a very, very grumpy one-year-old, and, you know, totally rightly so. I just remember thinking, oh yeah, her life's just sort of carried on as a single parent while I've been gallivanting around doing my thing. Oh, it's probably my turn to do a long shift now. But I think it's really interesting. You know, I talk to lots of people who've done adventurous things, and some of them, I don't mean any disrespect when I say this, but they're kind of what I'd maybe call the lost boys. They're refusing to grow up. I don't mean that in a nasty way, but they just live the life of an adventurer, and that's what they want to do forever. You haven't done that. I haven't done that. And I think I actually had a message from someone the other day in response to a podcast talking about, you know, how am I supposed to go and do these things when I've got a young family? Maybe that's a good question to ask you. You know, was there a moment, or how much do you think actually that your transition has been because you've been, you know, you want to be a decent husband and you want to be a good father?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And I don't think anybody's ever asked me that. And I don't know where the line is, but it has never felt contrived. I've never felt that what I do has changed to fit my family lifestyle. But I suspect below the conscious level, that has been a big part of it. I still think as a character, I'm more cerebral than gung-ho. I'm more if somebody gave me a choice between climbing a massive mountain that few people have been up, or noticing some patterns in a desert that nobody's ever seen before, I think I might find the latter more intriguing. And I think that would have been true all through my life. And I'd long before becoming a family man, I definitely always felt, well, not always, but certainly from my 20s onwards, I felt expeditions are a tool, a key to discovery, to genuine discovery. And I'm not talking about, I mean, I have been once in my life onto uncharted territory, but I'm not talking about that sort of discovery. I'm talking about, and I've written at times in the past about how the definition of an explorer is somebody who makes a journey, makes a discovery, and shares the discovery. Those three things. If you take any one of those three, any one of those parts of the triangle away, somebody ceases to be an explorer. And I think the word explorer became synonymous with adventurer. I think Shackleton played a part in that. I'm a big Shackleton fan, but for different reasons. And I think deep within me, from, you know, before I became a husband or a father, there was a sense that it's the discovery that is the exciting thing. Sometimes we need to spend weeks away from home for that to happen, but quite often I will make a genuine discovery, the sort of thing that I would include in a book, less than 200 meters from my back door. And it almost sounds cliche, but it's really, really true. I noticed a pattern in tree roots that can help us find direction in a clump of trees that I've walked through dozens of times. They're only about an hour's walk from home very, very recently. And that, to me, is really genuinely as exciting. I don't have to dress it up. I don't have to kid myself. That's as exciting as, feeling the wingtips about to touch the edges of a glacier-lined valley in Greenland or staring out over incredible landscapes from a summit. It's it really does. It fires my synapses in a bigger way. So it's been, I've always seen it as a happy coincidence. I think if the alternative was true, and I know many people because we rub shoulders professionally a lot, where the adventure is the genuine goal and that's their honest calling, who have quite a, you know, some pretty tough decisions to make, and they're not easy. And I think I could probably spot one or two people who've kidded themselves and one or two people who've done what they consider to be the honourable thing and drawn a line under that and look for something else. And it's certainly not for me to call what is right. I consider myself hugely fortunate that the discoveries that I'm driven by personally and that I rely upon for my income as a professional are not in any way related to machismo.
Yeah. And I mean, what a positive way to look at it in the modern world. Again, I won't bore you or the audience with my deep views on this, but I mean, we did I hosted a panel at the RGS not that long ago about the future of exploration. And, you know, one of our conclusions is that it's about stewardship and guardianship rather than, you know, traditional exploration, which is fairly colonial by nature. And I just think that the way that you look at it is so progressive. And again, I've said this a few times, but it really resonates with me. And as a young man, I was desperately craving probably purpose and meaning, but also respect. And the way that I looked for that was climbing mountains and being big and brave and tough. And that's probably why I've ended up as a bald, bearded, tattooed man. But now I'm into my 30s and, you know, I'm not kind of calling these people out, but it's all personal. And again, I don't take anything away from people's motivations, but to walk from the coast to the pole in Antarctica, there's not a single part of me that would consider that exploration. You know, a lot of the crevasses are filled in by a JCB. They're taking their red buttons that they can press and be pulled out at any minute. Yes, people die. Of course they do. Accidents happen. But you know, the way that you travel and the way that you move, I love this idea that you can step outside in England and walk into a forest and by the nature of what you've taken, go exploring. You know, you don't have your GPS, you don't have your iPhone. I mean, most people these days, and again, a final disclaimer, I'm not downplaining or raining on anyone's parade, but people can't navigate to Tesco's without their Google Maps these days. And there's so much power, I think, and it's so empowering to hear, whether there's busy people or people who aren't don't have the means to go to Antarctica or the desire or the time, actually you can explore in England very, very easily. And should probably.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree, of course. And I'm going to put myself on the spot here because it's good fun, but mainly because it might help us shed some light on what can otherwise be quite an abstract concept. I'm going to ask you to tell me, and we haven't prepared this, you can confirm that. We haven't touched base on this at all or exchanged an email or anything like that. I'm going to ask you to tell me randomly one thing you've seen outdoors close to home, if that's where you are, in the last 24 hours. Absolutely anything that pops into your mind.
One thing I've seen?
Yeah.
I noticed an oak tree for the first time on my drive into my studio this morning that I'd never seen before.
Okay, fantastic. So that qualifies as a discovery. You're sharing it. That's, you know, we've it's a journey. There's a discovery. Some sharing. That's exploring. And now, from my strange perspective, I'm going to ask you to go back one time and look at that oak tree. I'm going to ask you to find north using it. And there are over a dozen ways you can do that. The leaves, they won't be out as we're chatting now, but when they return, smaller on the south side, bigger on the north side. The shape of the branches, closer to horizontal on the south side, closer to vertical on the north side. The roots will stretch out towards the southwest. Now, I could go on. There are you know, over a dozen ways you can find direction using your oak tree, and there are over 20 ways you can make a map. You know, we can find where water is by looking at the veins in a leaf. We could probably find half a dozen different compasses in the lichens on your particular oak tree. And I'm not exaggerating when I say I think you or anyone else could go to that oak tree and make enough discoveries to fill a book of genuine things that nobody has ever noticed before. Whether they're to do with navigation or not is not the point. They would be genuine discoveries. And I think our brain loves that feeling when we discover something new for ourselves and it has some use. Now, nature is not all about human beings using it, but our brain has evolved to love and find delight in things that help us. And the helping doesn't have to be, we don't have to consume something for something to help us. The sun being due south in the middle of the day, you know, the world hasn't lost anything for us to notice that and it to help us find our way. But noticing those patterns and deriving some pleasure and benefit from it without any negative impact at all is, to me, it's the best of all worlds. It's discovery without, you know, I can't find a downside. And I've been inviting people to point one out for a while. I didn't know you were going to say the oak tree. You could have picked literally anything. There are discoveries to be made in absolutely anything we come across outdoors, anything we see, smell, hear, and occasionally taste.
But it's amazing. I mean, again, I gave you the speech before we spoke about how this isn't about me, but I'm going to break the rule and make it about me for a second. I've really struggled over the past few years with this kind of sense of I'm in love with two things which are incompatible, which are my family and my home life and my love of going away and experiencing these wild places. And I use that word very specifically, and enduring and enjoying them and thriving in them. And, you know, whether it's lockdown or becoming a father, that's really, it's not been stripped away. I traveled a lot last year. I went to some amazing places, including Antarctica and Greenland. You know, I'm a lucky boy. But, you know, if you combine, if one were to combine the way that you think and one of the ways that Alistair Humphreys thinks, you know, the author, he, in lockdown, he printed off an OS map with his house in the middle, which you can custom, you can customize an OS map. And he decided to go to every grid square. And I mean, to quote another guy I've spoken to, Ian Miller, who's climbed sea stacks on the west coast of Ireland, there's a lifetime of exploration there in one OS map.
Yes.
Now, I copied Al, and I have my OS map printed off in my hall at home, and I'm always looking when I go for a run or when I take my daughter out, you know, which grid square can we go to now? But I just think that's such an amazing way to reimagine the place that we live and the world that we live within, especially for those of us who consider Britain to be, you know, degraded and lacking in any sort of wilderness and this kind of, well, concrete car park these days.
Yes, definitely. And that, Al and I have met a few times. We bump into each other occasionally. And I think he's done some very interesting work in terms of not just the discovering part, but the sharing part. I think he was a true pioneer in terms of the getting the word out there. And I'm a big supporter of that idea that if we go back 100 years, something had to make page 3 or 5 of a newspaper before it was an expedition, in inverted commas, and the discoveries tended to involve sort of flags being planted still and that sort of thing. Whereas the philosophical appreciation that the discoveries can be really very small scale and don't have to be newsworthy in inverted commas. And now the ability to share is so much greater. I mean, I love that about, I mean, just very randomly on the sharing side, of course, podcasts are now part of this brave new world and social media and that sort of thing. And I learned so much that way. I can share something thinking I'm going to get one reaction and I absolutely love it. It's all part of the learning. I'm just related to that. I was very fortunate. I got sent one of those OS maps by Vanessa Lawrence, the former director. And it was very sweet. It just said Tristan's home on the front, this sort of thing. And I wanted to share that. And I think I put that with quite a few other maps that I had in my map box, which doesn't get access as much these days as it did when I was younger. But it's not the best. It's not the best looking thing. It's a bit tatty, and everything's a bit disorganized in that. And I was expecting a certain reaction. I got a totally different one, which was lots and lots of people complaining that their OCD had been triggered by my slightly relaxed approach to storing maps. It's such a strange. It's not directly relevant to exploration, but it is. I think that third part, the sharing part, that I mean, there is a negative side to it. I think that the I do genuinely worry about young people thinking, you know, a thousand photos of them smiling on top of a boulder in a nice landscape is you know, the route to nirvana. Maybe it is. I might be wrong. I am not an expert in those sorts of things. But on the positive side, we can go on journeys, make discoveries, and share in a way that 100 years ago, they'd really, really struggle to even comprehend.
I'm fairly sure you're not wrong. I think that extrinsic motivation is a worry. And, you know, we've talked about parenthood a bit, but it is a concern. And I think I struggle with it, and I'm 34. So God only knows what the teenagers are having to put up with. But, you know, this is a slightly woolly point, but I hope it's these sorts of things. This is my point, you know, really, to be less, I'm not being cryptic at all, but less cryptic. You know, we all have access to these skills and these places. We don't need a plane ticket to Antarctica. And I think maybe, you know, with that kind of accidental segue, like it might be interesting for you to define, as you see it, what natural navigation is. Because I think natural is quite an interesting word.
Yeah. navigation, the art and science of understanding where we are and how to find our way to where we want to go. And natural is as you've picked up there, it's a word that needs pinning down a bit. So my interpretation of the word natural in the context of natural navigation is tool-free, hands-free. So this goes into some quite interesting areas, because everyone will kind of guess that it's not using a smartphone or a GPS or something like that, but it's not even using sextants. I've either been formally trained or trained myself in using some of the older kit, from sextants back through sort of staffs and quadrants and all sorts of weird bits of kit, Kamals in the desert and things like that. But that's not natural navigation, because however sort of, you know, to certain people, that's wonderful, interesting kit, myself included. But it's not natural navigation because we still got a tool in our hands. However, using something like a TV satellite dish is natural navigation to me, because we don't have the tool in our hands. We are noticing something in our landscape. If there's a TV satellite dish there, we're obviously not in the wilds of Arabia or somewhere like that, but it's still valid observation of a landscape clue. I mean, in the UK, for example, TV satellite dishes point close to southeast, so they're one of the fastest, most expedient ways to get your bearings in a town or city, and that qualifies for me. So people quite often sort of, you know, nature is for me the richest, most fascinating part of it. Understanding that you can make a map using a butterfly, for example, is for me in every sense prettier and more fun than finding a way using a modern building. But, you know, if you notice there are shades on one side of a building and not on the other, you've got a compass there.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much of it, and obviously I don't know how many books you've written now, but it's a lot, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm just finishing my eighth, and they're all. I do get it's one of the signs that you've got a true friendship is when people can be rude and honest sort of simultaneously. And I do have a few sort of friends who are sort of saying, and they've said this for the last four books or something, you're done now, you've done it, you know, move on, you know, this sort of thing. You know, they're sort of slightly, I think, betraying the fact they haven't read them, which I understand. But what I'm doing is taking an idea that's as big as the world and bigger, because the clues spread out through the solar system into the stars and the universe. But I'm taking a very, very simple idea, which is that everything we sense outdoors has meaning. Everything is a clue or a sign. And each time, that's the core. That's the destination, if you want to use that analogy. And each time, I'm setting off on a journey of discovery towards it from a different direction. So I wrote a book called How to Read Water, which, as it says on the tin, is just taking the idea that every time we look at water, there's a clue there, whether it's a puddle, a lake, or an ocean, and in the secret world, or whether it's the same idea, but applied mainly to the sky, but also to how the sky interacts with the ground. And I'm not saying this because it suits me as an author. It's because I feel it very passionately in terms of the philosophy of this area. That sort of way of approaching it is both, it's as infinite and varied as the human character. And just as a bit of a tangent on that, I'm a poacher turned gamekeeper. When I was in my teens, nature didn't hold huge interest for me. I wasn't crawling around on my knees with a magnifying glass looking for beetles, as a lot of naturalists were. But what I discovered more by accident is that there's a way into fascination with the natural world, and it's a reflection of us as individuals. I wrote a book called How to Connect with Nature quite a few years ago. And I make the point in that you know, when we sit around, let's say we sit around a table with some friends and we're having a chat, we might know those friends that, that's the person who's interested in interior design. That's the person who is just fascinated by food, cooking, and restaurants, and that sort of thing. Now, those two people might say they have no interest in the natural world, but if you can get them onto the interior designer onto a path of understanding that all colours, textures, and practical applications of things we make our home out of are rooted in natural qualities. Cherry wood has a sort of a deeper, redder finish, pine wood a much lighter colour, that sort of thing, which in turn relates to how they where they appear and how they feature in a landscape. And if you're into cooking, then something like foraging is the bridge into the natural world. And natural navigation is the bridge, I firmly believe, for anyone who is passionate about travel in any form, whether it's walking on a Sunday or going around the world or doing big adventures. If the concept of travel excites you, then I believe that natural navigation is a fun, easily accessible way to suddenly find the natural world an enjoyable puzzle.
Yeah, and you're, clearly at a stage in your life where you know a lot about your subject matter. You know, you're highly successful in your field. But you, as you've said, you weren't kind of rummaging around on the floor with a magnifying glass when you were a teenager. What has this career, I guess specifically, not your career. What has this fascination and this passion given you?
The very honest answer is a genuine sense of purpose. And I'm now at the stage where I hope I've got a lot more to give, but parenthood and my age and stage, not just parenthood, has made me really fascinated to be fortunate through a lot of accidents to have found something that I love doing and hopefully do well, has made me equally super excited and apprehensive about the next generation. And I'm not just talking about my kids because that's too sort of subjective. It's when I meet school kids, I just have the same sort of thing going through my mind the whole time, which is kind of, if you don't find your thing, life's going to be less fun and tough than it needs to be. I think the younger generations have clocked onto something that wasn't prevalent when I was a youngster, which is the economics are a part of life's choices always and for all of us, but it is more complex. And I think this idea of going for experiences over assets is a very interesting one. We haven't seen it play out the whole way, and there may be some stings in the tail if nobody's got anything to their name by the age of starting a family or something like that. I honestly don't know, and I'm not an expert to sort of talk about that sort of thing. But I think this whole area is really fascinating, because if you, I think you're asking what it's sort of given me, and on a sort of one-dimensional sense, it's given me a really fun career. On another sense, I have a friend who's an incredible doctor, a consultant anaesthetist. I've got quite a few friends who are consultants in the medical profession. And they've said something very sort of, I don't want to share their sort of family history sort of too much, but there's a very interesting thing which ties in with something which I might call a sort of head on the pillow test, which is whatever you do, when you put your head on the pillow at the end of the day, can you sort of smile about the general thing you're doing? Now, we all have different callings and different emotional responses. For some people, they can't do that unless they are, a paramedic in a war zone. For some people, they can do it if they're, making money in financial services or some other area. And this is not a judgmental thing at all, but it is, I think, essential for all of us that we can put our head on the pillow at the end. And that's why it comes back to finding the thing. It doesn't have to, the person working in financial services, it might allow them to do some incredible charity things and things like that. But I don't, and again, I don't think everybody, and I think the world would be boring if there were X billion people running around solely, motivated by making other things better. There needs to be one or two people sort of going, the Edisons and Thomas Edison and people like that of old, who I've only read bits about him, so this might not be the best example, but I think the world does probably need people who wake up with a slice and say, I don't really care about anyone else or anything else. I'm going to do some extraordinary, crazy things, and I'm going to do them because they make me happy. So we're all somewhere on that scale. I'm not an expert, but when you ask me what it's sort of given me, I'm hugely grateful. I don't want to sound too sort of saccharine about this, but there were many, many, many times in my life where I did not think I would ever find something that I could throw myself into, sometimes for, you know, 20 hours a day, more often less than that, but with real passion, feeling that, there is, you know, sort of good purpose to it. And I don't want to kind of oversell the philosophical side of natural navigation, but the using nature signs, I do genuinely believe, helps us all in terms of spotting things that are genuinely important in our own lives. And I'm not going to sit here and say everybody needs natural navigation to get through life. I do believe it's necessary to have the most interesting journeys. But what I mean about helping us is that through natural navigation, I've learned that everything is a sign, as we were kind of playing around with earlier. And that has helped me personally to sometimes be more aware of situations that I was oblivious to otherwise. They can be very sort of simple things, like noticing the person who's sad in a room. It's not something, you know, I would necessarily have picked up on as quickly as I should have done 20 years ago. But genuinely, reading nature signs has made me more sensitive to the idea that one small observation can yield something quite profound and meaningful. If you're on a natural navigation expedition, it might tell you that, you know, there's a large dangerous animal approaching, like, you know, change in a bird call. But that sensitivity has led me to notice lots and lots of things. I regret not being more sensitive to them earlier in my life, but I can't sort of change that. I'm just grateful I am a bit more sensitive now. And I think that's, we all know, and it is a bit of a sort of a classic you thing, you know, we've all done it, and we all know people who can charge across a landscape, cover, you know, 30K of ups and downs, and feel it's the best day ever, and not actually have noticed anything at all. I think that goes hand in hand with possibly being in lots of other situations in life and being totally unaware of what's going on around you as well. So I think the things are complementary, and it's given me a sense that less of the world and people and every part of, you know, those situations slips me by, and I'm very grateful for that.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing, really. It's, you know, I am, you know, I've read lots of what you've written, but also you're really making me think as we're talking, and it's almost like this natural navigation, which you can then use in your everyday life and feeds into even me driving to my studio today and noticing the tree, which is, I hadn't ever considered that you would ask me that. I just noticed the tree sat at a traffic light. But it's almost like the epitome of curiosity, which is something we champion through our childhood and we champion with children. And then we kind of just strip it out and lose it as a culture, I think. Obviously not across the board. You and I are clearly very curious people, but it almost feels like an amazing way to reconnect with that curiosity on a dog walk or sat at a traffic light, in a way that would be very beneficial for our sanity as much as anything else. And, you know, I did write it down. I'm not going to pretend I didn't. But towards the start of this conversation, you said, if you were asked at 20 years old, why are you on planet Earth? What is the purpose of you? I think I'm going to cheekily specifically ask you for the answer to that question.
I'll do my best for an honest answer. I would really, really struggle. And my most honest answer at that age would probably be to do something fairly radical and more likely fail than succeed. That was my feeling at the time, was that I was, it comes back to something we talked about a lot earlier about the sense of comfort. I don't think the people most comfortable in their own skin or their own sort of situation are feeling they need to shake things up massively. But I was really uncomfortable at that age, and I feel uncomfortable just thinking about it now. But I did equally from a very young age have this slight sort of rebellious rattle cage feeling. I'll tell you a weird story on that. I was at school and I had an odd but good teacher who could tell when we were getting bored and would lob sort of philosophical grenades out to us. And he said, we're going to go around the class and throw out the one word that you know, sums you up in a way that makes you slightly different to everyone else at this school. And, you know, it's an uncomfortable exercise, and it's meant to be an uncomfortable exercise. And, you know, we had a few of the sort of predictable, dependable, I can't remember the words, but the fact I can't remember them is something. It's possible that somebody else in that class will recall the word I used, which was sabotage. And that, you know, I look back on that and go, that's not a totally happy sorted kid. And yet there was a positive within it, which is that, again, I'm far less interested in myself in this context than the next generation. But if we're young and we are struggling in any way, and that manifests in that feeling of, I just kind of want to smash things, and very young children do manifest in that way. I was watching a drama on TV where an unhappy seven-year-old was smashing things in the home, and it felt sort of true to me. But if we have that sense, there is a very positive thing within it, which is it is the universe whispering to us, kind of like, you don't have to just break things. You can, you know, dismantle and put them back together in a slightly more interesting way. And that when we're perhaps, which is part of youth, I wouldn't ever want to be a young person that didn't ever experience sort of, you know, anger or frustration. But the frustration comes sometimes because we can feel the negative side of those messages, but we don't yet have any sort of, forgive the navigation sort of pun here, but we have no roadmap of the positive side of it. But that feeling, which I had incredibly strongly as a 20-year-old, and I was continuing to do sort of rebellious things I was rebelling for the first 25 years of my life. But that was, again, it's that word sabotage was, I was feeling probably in a very negative mindset, and I was, without even realizing it, I was vocalizing a sense that I was only on the negative side of this feeling. If we can find our thing, then we understand that something isn't just about smashing things. It might be about turning them upside down or looking at them in a different light or something like that. And that's the positive thing. So if there are, if there are young people listening to this or parents listening to this, it's something I feel very passionate about. And if it kind of resonates with you, if you know, kids, you know, are shaking it up in a not entirely sort of positive way, then I feel very passionately, and I would love to find ways to communicate this more effectively and possibly broadly, is that's the start of possibly something really very exciting. And I don't think that's hugely original, but it is something I feel quite strongly about, having been through one flavor of it.
Yeah. And I mean, I have to now ask, so, you know, you've answered as the 20-year-old and explain why, but you said earlier, I think the phrase was, I'm now firmly middle-aged, and I feel like I'm at the start of that journey. I can resonate with that. But why do you think now you're on planet Earth, and what's the purpose of you? What's the plan?
I don't think this fully answers the question, but I feel perhaps my role, if I have one, and there's nothing guaranteeing I ever have a role in inverted commas, is to be a creative disruptor that rattles cages and helps people not always see the natural world differently, see it for the first time properly, deeply. And I think it really helps to be a poacher turned gamekeeper. It helps to be a rebel. I think there are some, you know, lovely, nearly always pretty nice people who've been absolutely fascinated by nature all their lives, who actually struggle to bring people into the fold because they haven't been a poacher, and so I if I was asked now, I think that's possibly my role, but I'm not so caught up in my own universe that I believe I necessarily have a role. It might be time for someone else to. I've been so sort of fortunate, and I am genuinely so sort of grateful that somebody tapped me on the shoulder and said, good innings, you know, you're done, time for some 20-year-old who's feeling a bit uncomfortable to you know, shake things up now. I'd say, yeah, that's probably a good shout. But I'll keep pushing.
I would strongly encourage you to keep pushing, if that's okay, for the benefit of the rest of us.
Thank you.
I'm conscious of time. Just to wrap this up, I always ask people the same two questions at the end of every conversation. Maybe I'll write a book one day with their answers. But the first is, what scares you?
I do feel fear a lot, and it's fear / anxiety. I've never ever got to the point where I'm entirely comfortable in medium social gatherings. I'm quite comfortable in a room with 100 people in it, and I not something I could have done as a young person, but I can stand up on a stage and talk to 1,000 people. But if you put me in a room with 20 people I half know, I find it absolutely terrifying. I genuinely, I'm not sort of saying this for effect. I don't sleep well for 2 or 3 nights before it, and I find it scary. Yeah, there are probably lots of other things, but if that's the thing that you know I would genuinely rather be on a small boat in a storm in the middle of nowhere than do that too often.
That's a very honest and unique answer. Thank you. What brings you hope?
I am a general sort of optimist, and we are going through a period which none of us sort of know how it sort of plays out. But the narrative is that we're not making changes in lots of areas fast enough to meet the challenges that we face. But the thing that gives me hope is the ability for individuals and groups and populations and the entire, the human being in whatever sort of numbers to make decisions and quite creatively solve problems and make things better faster. So I think most of our, I've made it a point since the beginning of doing what I do to not sort of get into politics. Cause I think funnily enough, I find it's not sort of helpful for a lot of the sensitivity I need for what I do. But that's the thing that gives me hope, is I genuinely believe that humans are, if you'll forgive a slightly longer answer to this, humans are, there's some stories in aviation psychology, and I've had to take an exam in it to get one of the qualifications I needed. You learn about how there are different character types, and up at the front end of a large aircraft, there will always be at least two people. And in the ideal scenario, you have two very different character types there. You have the person who is a systems manager, and that is the typical airline pilot of today, because they will go through all of their career, hopefully, without being faced with a crisis. But you also want somebody up the front who is good in a crisis and actually gets a bit bored and fidgety and is a bit not suited to, a 10-hour flight with nothing bad happening. And I learned studying this in the aviation psychology that in the post-war period, there were far too many sort of, crisis handlers, and not enough people who are good at doing the 200 item checklists and the boring important stuff. And we've now switched perhaps the other way. There are a couple of systems managers up the front, but we're not entirely sure how they react when the engine falls off. And that sounds, unrelated to hope. But my general sort of feeling is in times of relative calm or prosperity, the systems managers get to call the shots. And in times of crisis, there are just enough people who are prepared to hop into the sea. And I'm not talking about the obvious things here necessarily. People will be leaping to all sorts of conclusions about what I'm thinking of. I might be thinking that, might be thinking of other things. I'm just talking about my general hope, whether it's something as banal and pointless as something not functioning right in the local village or something much, much broader and global. That's the thing that gives me hope, is that the there are always enough people spread through humanity to kind of swap seats when it comes to it. Does that make sense?
It does. And that another brilliant and unique answer.
Cheers.
So I don't think I've ever said this live at the end of a podcast, but I really, really, really hope we get to have another conversation one day, because I feel like there's 8 books worth of stuff we could talk about, and we've probably just scratched the surface. But thank you very much. That was one of my favorite conversations I've had for this podcast in a long time.
Oh, thanks so much, Matt. I really, really enjoyed it. And let's have that second chat, because there are so many things you've done I want to hear about. And yeah.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
I'd really enjoy that.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening. For more information, head to theadventurepodcast.co.uk. If you want to get in touch, then I have a new email address, and you can email me at matt@terraincognita.studio. And finally, as always, please do leave us an honest review on iTunes.